Good morning, members and testifiers. Today is the call this meeting of State Government Finance and Elections to order for February 23rd, 2021. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, with this meeting is being held virtually, and I will let the committee assistant take the roll.
Chair Nelson.
I'm here.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson present.
Representative Nash.
Present.
Representative Bonner. Representative Bonner. Representative Drazkowski.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Cleburne.
Present.
Representative Kosnick.
Present.
Representative Mason.
Present.
Representative New Brindley.
Present.
Representative Quam.
Present.
Representative Bonner. A quorum is present.
Thank you. Representative Bonner, I see her on my screen. I don't know if she can hear us or not. Can you hear us? Maybe you want to text her, Sydney, to make sure.
I'll do that.
Okay. And with that, I'll move on to the minutes. Representative Claiborne, did you get a chance to look at the minutes from February 19th?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I move that the minutes from February 19th be adopted as written.
Thank you. Representative Claiborne moves the minutes from February 19th. Approval of the minutes. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Our minutes have been approved. Next, we've got bills here coming up, and the first one is Representative Hewitt, House File 575, and I'll move House File 575 to be referred to the General Register. Representative Hewitt, explain your bill, and I see you got a couple testifiers.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, and thank you, members, for hearing the bill. This bill simply changes or adds, it basically adds to the individuals that can actually perform a marriage ceremony in the state of Minnesota or
to... One second, Representative Hewitt. I forgot to adopt the committee report. This came up from the local government committee. So, members, I move the committee report, approval of the committee report from the local government committee for House File 575. Everyone in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, now I'll move House File 575 to be before us. Representative Hewitt, sorry for that.
That's okay, Mr. Chair. No, but it gave me a while to think about the actual title of what it is. So it's marriage officiant is what the title is that who can perform that. Right now in Minnesota, you have to be an ordained minister or a judge to perform ceremonies in the state of Minnesota. I had a personal problem with this, and I want you all to know that the international lobbyists of notaries did not come forward to push this bill. I still haven't heard from them, actually. But this was more personal, and then I looked into it, where a few years ago, before I was in the legislature, I was asked by my nephew to perform his ceremony, and I was in the process of becoming a Catholic deacon. And without thinking, I said, oh, certainly, I got to figure out what the criteria is to do it, but I will get it done. So I went ahead and went online and became an ordained minister of the Church of Risen Christ, I think it is. And you can do it in 10 minutes, pay your fees, and you're done. You file your paperwork at the county, and you now are an ordained minister. The ramifications for that were horrible because actually, I'm on hold for being a Catholic deacon because in my church, I have to get a special dispensation from Rome now because I was an ordained minister in another faith. That's just my personal problem. But then when this bill got announced, I had a couple other people start to call me. One was a bride that was in the a married person in the process of actually dissolving her marriage. She went to the courthouse to get her marriage license because it never appeared. They never followed up on it. Well, lo and behold, the good friend of the groom's that never filed the marriage certificate. And I heard two of those horror stories. So So then I started talking in, around the house here, and I found out that what's the best way to do this, what other states doing. And I'm not taking away ordained ministers. What I'm doing is just adding somebody that the state can hold accountable. We hold our notaries at a pretty high statute. They have to have criminal backgrounds. They have to go through a process. And if they didn't file the paperwork and do what they're supposed to do, we can hold them accountable, because marriage is sacred, and we want to make sure that people are able to, if they choose not to have a religious ceremony, that there is options for them, and that the state is making sure that those are good people doing it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I see we have an amendment. Now, this came in late, but it's a little late because of some issues, but it's basically just changing a couple of words. So do you want to move? I'll move the House, the A2 amendment, 575A2. If you want to explain what that amendment does, Representative Hewitt.
I believe it's a technical amendment that the Secretary of State had me look into, just to change a few small items in the bill. I forgot all about there was an amendment. I apologize for that, Mr. Chair. And they are here to explain what we did with the bill a little bit.
And members, the A2 amendment, basically on line 2, on page 2, line 16, it changes, it deletes notary credentials and adds a commission. And then on line 19 of page 2, it deletes credentials are, inserts commission is what it does. So it's very technical in nature. So I'll move, like I said, I move the A2 amendment. All in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed?
No.
The moment the amendment passes. You've got testifiers. First we have Mr. Berry. I think we just got the one testifier, Mr. Berry, and then we have Mr. Black or Ms. Black from the Secretary of State's office to answer questions. If they're already on the notary part or on the amendment. Mr. Berry, if you want to please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure, thank you. My name is Vince Berry. I live in Apple Valley currently. I'm one of John Hewitt's constituents, and I'm also a notary through the state of Minnesota. When Representative Hewitt first put out a notification that this was one of the things that he was introducing, I decided to throw my support behind it for the reasons that he mentioned, the practicality and the accountability. So with the practicality, with the limitations on gathering sizes, this makes sense. You've got greater choice for the type of ceremony you can do, whether it's secular or religious, and for the accountability, practicality as well too. If you're in a pinch and you know that you can go to, you can get a notary to do your ceremony, you've got a searchable database to see who's local, you know, with the Secretary of State. In terms of accountability, for the reasons that he mentioned as well too, you've got a notary that's got, you know, they've got incentive and they understand the responsibility to get that paperwork filed in a timely fashion, make sure it's correct. But it also offers a layer of consumer protection. You've got a state approved officiant, and you know, there's repercussions that can be taken against that person. I hate to say it that way, but you know, it just makes sense that you've got somebody to hold accountable and go back to that, again, has the incentive to get that paperwork filed in a timely fashion. And those are the main two reasons that I'm supporting HF 575.
Thank you, Mr. Berry. And I see we have a couple of questioners. Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Hewitt, does this allow all notaries to do this? Because as you know, as state representatives, we have the ability to be notaries, and I don't feel qualified to do this. And while I know we don't have the Las Vegas version of the Elvis Chapel of Love, I do recognize the expediency of this, but want to hear more about, the all notaries, but two, I appreciated you sort of articulating the difference between a faith-based ceremony and a civil ceremony. Is that really what you're after here? Or maybe you can shed some light on my two questions.
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Nash. Great questions. I'm going to defer to the Secretary of State on, because we're a special kind of notaries, and it might be good for our education to know that, because they did such a good job last time they explained it. But yes, Representative Nash, I think that's really where it splits up, is that people that don't have a faith should not be forced into having one off the internet. My faith is very, as you know right now, my faith is very personal and close to me. And to have that complication with my own personal problem there really is upsetting to me. But, you know, I think that we definitely give people the option here. They can use a judge, yes, but this brings in more individuals that we can hold accountable. And I hope I elaborated on that enough. It doesn't take away, because if I wanted to do that, I would write a bill that says you have to be somebody that went to a seminary and things like that. I mean, I looked at that and I don't think that's fair, but I also want to make it another option here of what we could do really simply and modify, well, not even modify, but to look at adding to something in order to do. But I'd like to ask the Secretary of State's office to explain exactly what kind of notary we are and to explain how that could play within this or vice versa. Are they available?
Yes, Ms. Black is here. Ms. Black, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with the answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my name is B.B. Black. I'm General Counsel at the Office of the Secretary of State. And I can tell you that this bill would allow for commissioned notaries. Those are the folks who are applying to our office to be notaries and whose commissions are issued, and they are appointed by the governor. So they are public officials, and in their role as commissioned notaries public, and they are confirmed by the other body. People who are legislators are also notaries, but they are not commissioned. They are ex officio. So that includes people like representatives and members of the other body, as well as judges and a number of other people who are defined in Chapter 359 of the statutes. But this would not give ex officio notaries the ability to do to solemnize marriages, just the commissioned notaries. And part of the reason for that is because the ex officio notaries do not file with us. They are simply notaries by virtue of their office. The Department of Commerce does have regulatory authority over the commissioned notaries as well. So if there is an issue, so for example, in the example that Representative Hewitt used where the person who solemnized the marriage never filed it, there would be a jurisdiction and leverage in the Department of Commerce to take disciplinary action. So that has the notaries public who are commissioned, there is some traction there if there are issues. And also there are 60,000 notaries. Going to the question of faith-based marriages, I'm sure some of them are in a position where they might be themselves deacons or other minor officials in their faith. So there's an overlap here, I'm sure, out of those 60,000 notaries. But that's the way that would work. It would not include automatically members of the legislature or other ex officio notaries public.
Thank you, Ms. Black.
And Mr. Chair, just very briefly.
Representative Nash, follow up.
Yeah. Is there, Representative Hewitt, is there a fiscal implication for training materials on steps that the notaries are now going to have to perform or learn about, or curricula change or anything like that?
Representative Nash, there was not a fiscal note found that would involve this. Basically, I know from my own experience, I was given a piece of paper by the county and said, this is what you have to follow through. So there is no, I mean, we can look into this to see if we do pass the process. If we do this, then we can come back and revisit it to see if we're going to have to do that. But I don't anticipate that. I think this, to me, seems of a way to be held more accountable for what you're doing. I don't mean to say this, but I do. We've simplified marriage to just going on the internet and getting a license from the Church of the SpaghettiOs. In this bill, I think that I held somebody accountable that really can do that and really, you know, that to make sure that the paperwork is filed. We would never want to have somebody in a situation like this bride I brought up that had to go back and untangle her taxes, had to go back and do all sorts of stuff that they filed together. That was really basically not a lie. So that story hit me more than any other story. I mean, mine I can get through, but hers just really devastated me to have that happen to her. So,
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions were answered.
Thank you, Representative New. With that, members, I see no more questions. I'll renew my motion that House File 575 as amended be referred to the General Register. Ms. Spreck, can you take the roll?
Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Nash?
Aye.
What was that? Sorry.
Aye.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski?
No.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Greenman? Representative Cleavorn?
Aye.
Representative Kosnick?
No.
Representative Mason?
Aye.
Representative New Brindley?
Aye.
Representative Quam? Representative Quam?
Aye.
With 10 ayes and 2 nays, the motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Or thank you, Ms. Spreck. The bill is referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Hewitt. The next bill we have is House File 525. And Representative Mason, do you want to move your committee report, commission report?
Yes, Chair. I would like to move House File 325.
Move the division report first. Represent the division report first.
Oh, I'd like to move the division report from the local government division.
Representative Mason moves to adopt the local government division report on House File 325. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. With that, Representative Mason, you want to move your bill?
Yes, sir. I would like to move House File 325 to the General Register.
And you want to briefly explain the bill, and then we can get to testifiers.
Okay, thank you. This is a bill that I had carried last session as well. It's one that we've heard. It's come about, as you'll hear from some of our testifiers, because of the salary cap that is placed currently on the hiring by local governments. They're in a position now where it's been becoming very difficult for them to find the qualified candidates that they need. And I think what I will do is let my testifiers elaborate on the issues that they're dealing with.
And I'll start with, I've got a list here, Mr. Gary Carlson from the League of Cities. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gary Carlson, and I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to thank Representative Mason and co-authors Representative Joachim, Elkins, and Hewitt for authoring House File 325, a bill that would repeal the state statute that limits the compensation paid to local government employees. I provided the committee with a letter that highlights the league's support, but if you would allow me, I'd like to elaborate on several key points. First, the repeal of this statute is an essential element of local control. Our city councils and county boards are in the best position to make these compensation decisions to attract and retain employees. The local government salary cap is really not based on the economic realities of hiring, and perhaps more importantly, it challenges the ability of local governments to attract and retain qualified and exceptional candidates. to Minnesota local government positions. The waiver process in current law is really not a solution. And I know many people have talked about that. Why doesn't that work? The process is not timely. And the conclusions of Minnesota Management and Budget, which is the state agency designated to make these determinations, does not always yield the results that meet the local circumstances and local needs. Many times they grant waivers that are only a portion or a small portion of the requested variance. Minnesota is the only state that we are aware of that has this type of state-imposed compensation limit on local governments. We are one in the nation that has decided to limit the salaries that are paid to those that work in local government. In 2005, I want to mention that the league did work to repeal the salary cap, and we had a robust discussion at that time about ending the cap entirely. And in the end, the compromise was to start with 110% of the governor's salary as a limit and then adjust it annually for inflation. And that was a temporary Band-Aid. And for a few years, we did not see local governments bumping up into that cap. But as the economy has changed, as certain positions and the demands of those positions have changed, it's become very apparent that the cap has created more and more pressure. And we have in recent years had at times over 40 requests for variances from the cap that have been submitted to the Department of Management and Budget for waivers. In summary, we're just asking you to allow local city councils and county boards to make these important compensation decisions. We as city council members will live with those decisions. That's what we're elected to do. And we're just asking for that authority to do that, of our own volition. So with that, I also have Mr. Luke Hellier from the city of Lakeville. He's a city council member there who has dealt with this issue. And I would like to turn it over to him to make a few points about the Lakeville experience.
Well, thank you, Mr. Carlson. He's the next on my list. So, Mr. Hellier, do you want to identify yourself for the record and then proceed?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Luke Hellier. I'm a member of the Lakeville City Council. And thank you for the opportunity to share my support today for House File 325. Removing the salary cap for municipal employees is included in our city's legislative priorities, actually. And I'll just share a quick story. In 2018, our director of public works left his job for a new opportunity in southern Minnesota. Our HR team worked diligently to find a replacement. We had a dozen or so candidates, including two finalists from out of state, but neither was the right fit. And following several months of not filling the position, we ended up hiring a consultant at the fee of $30,000 to recruit and find a qualified candidate that happened to be from a suburb 15 miles away. I share that story not because it was an issue about compensation merely, but to share how difficult it can be to find the right candidate for a job. Not unlike the private sector, finding qualified candidates for positions can be frustrating and downright difficult. On top of that, a burden on our budget and the taxpayer. One of the ways to prevent having to spend significant taxpayer resources on finding qualified workers is adequately compensating employees to incentivize them to stay. Unfortunately, when it comes to our top staff, our hands are tied to ensure that we're paying a competitive wage with above average benefits. I would much rather give a raise of a few thousand dollars to a qualified employee than spend tens of thousands on a search firm to find a candidate from another region. I think some opponents may say that lifting the ban could result in a bidding war among cities of who can pay the most. But as far as I know, that has not happened with school superintendents who don't fall under the same cap. In theory, capping compensation of municipal employees should set a level playing field on recruiting and retention. However, in practice, it's a total failure. Last year, Lakeville was indeed granted the waiver under the current law, but now our compensation is set by bureaucrats in St. Paul. We currently have one employee that meets the cap, but in the very near future, three others will be against the cap, including our police chief. And under no circumstance am I allowing our police chief to leave. Furthermore, the current law greatly impacts cities large and small who operate their own electric utilities. It wouldn't take much for to recruit a utility manager to a neighboring electric cooperative in greater Minnesota with better compensation. For those reasons, I urge your support, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Hellier. The next person I have on my list is Mr. Patrick Keene. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good morning, Chair Nelson and members of the committee.
My name is Patrick King, and I'm a council member from the city of Rochester. The state salary cap is of particular interest to Rochester, a city of 119,000 residents and 1.4 million visitors each year. We operate an airport, a public utility, wastewater treatment facility, a library, and other city services. We are a regional city with a national medical reputation. From my perspective, the 15-plus year old salary cap likely made more sense when it originated, but it has not kept pace with the world around us. The specific issues and harms to our city are, number one, the salary cap creates skilled leadership retention issues. A retention issue specific example happened in our city at our municipal utility just last quarter. We lost a key leader to a private sector job with salary being the reason given for leaving. The state salary cap puts our utility at a competitive disadvantage when competing for skills. And to be sure, other states and investor-owned utilities are well aware of our constraints, and they play off of those. Number two, the salary cap impacts our leadership team recruiting, including candidates of color and other highly recruited candidates. I should note that the utility executive we lost last quarter was a person of color in a visible community position on our leadership team. And number three, the salary cap removes local control. While Rochester sees it in the city's best interest to run municipal utility and to hire top city administrators at competitive levels, these missions put us at a competitive disadvantage as an organization and as we operate with these constraints. The current salary cap does have a waiver process, but the waiver process has become weighted down by volume, and the results are not consistent. The waiver process is not a realistic option in a real-time competitive hire or competitive retention situation. As a council member and part of an elected body, we have to answer to our voters. Along with setting policy for a large city, we clearly understand our fiduciary responsibilities to the voters. Lifting the cap on cities and counties would not open excessive new spending. It would allow Rochester to make better decisions on staffing and leadership for running a large, complex operation. Lifting the salary cap would not cost the state government $1 in additional spending. I should note that our city's 2021 budget of over $470 million, with a local level levy of around $80 million, we held that at a 0% increase moving into the 2021 budget. Many of the salaries we are talking about today come from enterprise and utility funds and not from our property tax levy. Thank you for your time this morning, and I will stay on to address questions or other issues as they come up. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Keene. The next person on my list is Mr. Matt Mossman. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Well, thank you. Good morning, Chair Nelson and committee members. My name is Matt Mossman. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Inter-County Association. Our association's members include 15 of Minnesota's larger and faster growing counties. Together, we're about 35% of Minnesota residents. Thank you as well to Chair Mason and all of the fellow authors for proposing and championing House File 325. MICA strongly supports the full repeal of the local government compensation limit called for in House File 325, and we urge the legislature to pass this legislation in 2021. The repeal of these provisions in 43A.17 would restore local control and accountability over the pay of staff that are hired, managed, retained, promoted by local officials. You've heard that Minnesota is the only state that has such a limit. But even more broadly, I think the limit frankly confounds the fundamental linkage that otherwise exists for all private and public employers between hiring, retention, pay, and performance. I'm going to be joined today as well by Commissioner Ken Brown from Olmsted County, who can add local perspective, as you've heard from Rochester and Lakeville, as I think those examples are very important to understanding the challenges here. But first, I want to real briefly underscore that this is a statewide issue and highlight some policy flaws that I think fall into two buckets. First, the current law, Mr. Chair and members, undermines rather than enhances government efficiency, transparency, and accountability. It does so in a couple of ways. One is by shifting the decision-making authority for local official paid decisions from local elected officials to a state agency. And in doing so, it undermines transparency and accountability because most of the public likely assumes that these decisions are made by the local elected officials who hire these high-level administrators who increasingly are at the cap and having their salaries either capped or set by a state agency. And I would underscore as well that the LCC's role here is only advisory, meaning that the law further results in no elected officials effectively having direct oversight over the compensation of decisions that are then made for these senior level staff. It also, I believe, undermines efficiency because the process itself has, as has been discussed by others, is redundant, bureaucratic, with the decisions that are made by MMB often being done so after undertaking the state agency's analysis that can sometimes result in decisions that are a bit nonsensical relative to the local job market constraints. To be clear, our issue is not with MMB, but with the results of the effects of the law itself. Often local HR professionals are typically engaging who have a better understanding of the local economic realities are already undertaking their own analysis to advise county boards in the first place on the decisions that are made to set salaries. And just real quickly, secondly, the law interferes with the best practices and the economic assessments and market conditions that are at the foundation of the pay recommendations of local officials and the decisions that they make. For example, one suburban, it is clearly affecting the ability of our local governments to recruit for these important positions, not only within the state, but nationally as well. One suburban county recently conducted a national search for several senior positions and netted no national or even regional interest that they attribute to the compensation limits. Another county exemplifies how
rate. Can we wrap up, Mr. Mousman?
I will. Mr. Chair, I would just highlight that the issues are also impacting a variety of positions like engineers, IT professionals, and others, as well as a number of positions that are potentially raising questions about pay equity in that I know we have one central Minnesota county where three staff people about to hit the cap are all in positions that are held by women currently. So for those issues and a number of others, I would turn to Mr. Brown to highlight the Olmstead experience as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Brown. Can you please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony?
I'm Brown. I'm an Olmstead County Commissioner. I've been on the board since 2003, 18 plus years now, and I have been an advocate of removing the salary cap legislation since I got on the board. I've never understood it, didn't understand why that control needs to be in place. We are all accountable locally to our constituents, just as you all are. If we went off half drunk and gave everybody a 10% raise, that would probably have ramifications to our next election. And what we're talking about in most of the large counties where this is becoming a major problem is we're talking about maybe 6 to 8 positions that we need to be competitive for. This is not a countywide issue. It is at the top, our best leaders that we want to be able to compensate and retain. We tend to, as others, get creative in terms of how we can compensate them additionally in a non-cash, perhaps, way. Examples are we tried to hire a human resource director. We got 2 or 3 people coming from out of state. Once they found out that the salary cap was there, the cost of living and real estate in Rochester, they turned it down. We hired internally to a younger, very qualified woman that left fairly soon because she looked at the salary cap and realized that her career earnings would be severely impacted. So she left for a better paying job. Hiring, as Mr. Mossman said, in the professional levels, IT, county engineers. Those are very market competitive functions that we have to compete on, and not being able to adequately compensate or at least be in the game based upon some other features of public employment that can help that situation, we're at a loss. Lastly, we have competed for waivers. We believe it's a fairly arcane set of criteria. I don't blame MMB, but the last time around, we both went. Rochester got a fairly significant bump. Homestead was denied. So we further becomes a further complication. Our own major sister city in the county is able to at least pay better for their administrator and higher level positions than we are. It just creates inherent conflict. And I have never understood why we are the only state in the nation that feels like we have to exert this kind of control locally on elected officials who are accountable to all of our constituents. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. And members, I see we have Representative Quam has an amendment. Representative Quam, do you want to move your amendment?
Yes, I would like to move my DE1 amendment.
And Representative Quam, how does your DE1 differ from the bill as before us?
Well, first of all, the bill before us removes the waiver process and the cap. So the amendment increases the cap, maintains the inflationary connection, and then moves the appeals process from MMB to the LCC. My feeling is that by improving the appeals process, fairness could be re-injected. It doesn't make outward sense what happened between Olmsted and Rochester. And the LCC has more balance and diversity of background, which would allow for, I hope, better understanding, as opposed to MMB, which they've done several things that have confused me in their decisions, and not limited to just this area. And so, frankly, this would allow for an improvement to the process we have. I have consternation with the unsettling situation we're in with the pandemic. State funds and budgets are in flux. Local funds and budgets are in flux. And the timing of just removing this cap, I believe, could end up being problematic. And that is part of the intent here, is to allow a transition. When things settle out, we can actually meet in person, hold a meeting. And I think meetings go fine with Zoom, but not as good as when we're in person. And we can have side discussions with the testifiers, get a better understanding on the full scope. And that is, pretty much the sum. A transition, improvements, and then I'm sure that this would reappear next year or the year after when things are more stable. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. I have questions here of the amendment, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you. I'm not quite sure who should answer this, but I guess I'm curious about the $200,000 limit, and specifically how that number was arrived at. And I'm a little concerned in that I'm wondering if the market shouldn't be dictating the salaries rather than legislature stepping up once every 10 years or so to try and readjust those. It feels like by doing that, we may be actually creating this sort of artificial sense where the legislature continues to need to intervene. But I'm curious how we arrived at that number.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought that it'd be good to have a adjustment. You know, the amount was going up by inflation. And having seen some of the issues, I thought if we're going to do something, it's around 180 now. And so a little better than a 10% bump adds more to the ceiling and would allow for people that are near that top to have a decent increase. Anytime you'd be a double digit increase, I think is not inconsequential. It doesn't guarantee that everybody that was near the top would get the full bump, up to the 200,000, but it gave some leeway. And that's where that figure came from. Thank you.
Representative Bonner.
Mr. Chair, and if I can, so if I understand correctly, we've raised the cap temporarily, but we haven't put any provision in place to account for inflation or other factors. And so very likely they may be back here at the legislature within a few years having this conversation again. I'm just curious if someone could speak to that or if that is accurate that we have removed the inflation indicator.
Representative Bonner, in the amendment, and he does, there is a beginning in 2023 on line 1.12, there's an inflation adjustment in the cap, that's in the amendment.
Okay, apologies. I may have missed that piece.
Okay. Representative Elkins, you were next.
Yeah, just a quick question for the author. How often does the full legislative coordinating committee meet? I mean, I'm on three subcommittees, but they meet very irregularly. I'm guessing that the full legislative coordinating committee probably meets, what, monthly?
Mr. Gehring, maybe you can answer that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, the LCC itself doesn't have a standing meeting schedule. It meets at the call of the chair.
Yeah, that's what I would have guessed.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just don't think that cities can wait around for the LCC to call a meeting when they're in a salary negotiation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next person I have on my list is Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're on an amendment, but I'm just going to make my wrap-up comments here as well. It was suggested that maybe the cities, we're talking a lot about local control, and we would extend this waiver to cities that give up or do not have local government aid. So that would make my counselor probably happy here testifying. But I just think, at a time when we've got real unemployment of about 10%, we're looking at increasing the salary caps or removing the salary caps for bureaucrats. And over this last pandemic, bureaucrats have hardly been laid off, where we've got business owners that have told me that they've had to either completely close their business or lay off 40% of their staff due to the shutdowns. I just think it's kind of insulting to bring this bill up, and it's very tone deaf to what's going on in our economy. I recognize that, there's some aches at the top level of pay scales, but I don't think this is the appropriate time to take it up. And further, this bill hasn't changed at all from last year, and so I'm not sure at the serious intent to actually get this passed without making too many adjustments to actually try to make some progress on this. And just doing the same thing as we've done in the past and trying to pass it now, that doesn't seem to be a good strategy. So I'll be voting no.
Representative Claiborne. And then we'll go to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually concerned about the very question that Representative Elkins raised about the Legislative Coordinating Commission. But I would say this is truly, for the City of Plymouth, a local control issue. And I would just like to stand up for the hardworking people of all of our communities. Our top executives in our cities are not bureaucrats. They are really hardworking, dedicated officials. And they are hired to do yeoman's work and to do it for the, I mean, I've watched our city officials and they are on call 24/7 and they give their all to our communities, and to have them denigrated and to be called bureaucrats is just unacceptable to me. And I would just ask us to please honor the work that the people do for our communities and our counties and our municipalities day in and day out. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Quam, you got the final word on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And having been on the claims committee and even chaired it for many times, I'm used to people coming to the legislature and having a diverse input on important matters to them. Having the LCC meet and take care of this, I don't think is problematic. And I think that broader scope view would be advantageous. But the testimony today has illustrated there is a bit of a divide between an all or nothing on this. Last time the bill went and didn't go. So this amendment is meant to be a compromise to try and find something in the middle. What happens, happens. But thinking a compromise is not a bad thing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. With that, Representative Quam's amendment, the DE1 amendment, this is a voice vote. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
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 No. The amendment is not adopted. Member, Representative, any questions on the bill? Representative Roskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We've seen this bill again. While the government employees are working from their basement through this pandemic for the last year, we don't know a single one that has been laid off. I don't. I haven't heard anybody mention any names of a government employee. The mechanic is down at the garage twisting nuts and bolts and cutting the U-bolts off of cars in order to do his work. The nurse is doing her work and helping people through this pandemic. Every single day they get in their car and they go to work. Government employees largely are working from home. We even heard from the state auditor of all of the offices in the state that the state auditor has, every single one is closed and those employees are working from home. We're seeing this throughout government. And as Representative Koznick, I think, mentioned real well, businesses are getting slammed. And here we have government coming, members. These people are being paid $180,000 a year to work from home for the last year, to be from home. And that's not enough. You have to be kidding me. Tone deaf isn't enough. It is insulting that this bill is even before this legislature. I would ask the chair and other, or the author and others, how many people in their community they've talked to and asked them if $180,000 isn't enough for these government employees. The governor is paid, what is it, Mr. Chair, $128,000, if I remember right. Many of the department heads were at that or less, and now they've been raised to $140,000 or $150,000. We've got, as reported by Mr. Carlson, 40 cities on the list on average. That's 4.5% of the cities in the state that want to increase the spending in these areas. The other 95% are doing it just fine. I just don't understand, Mr. Chair. This is misdirected. This is tone deaf. Democrats are out of touch with the people of Minnesota, and I hope the people of Minnesota are watching. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It was more of a comment. Representative Elkins, you're next on my list.
Yeah. Representative Druskowski's point, I know that the city of Bloomington, for example, has laid off 23 people so far during this pandemic because of its financial shortfalls. So there are lots of local government workers that are losing their jobs during this downturn. And I just want to point out again that this is kind of penny wise and pound foolish. I can't tell you how many times I would see somebody like a public works director, a city CIO, leave and go into the private sector, become a consultant, and then come back and do the same work for that city, but at a greatly inflated rate as a consultant rather than an employee. This just makes fiscal common sense, and I strongly urge a yes vote on this bill.
Representative Nash, do you want to go last, or do you want? I've got two more. I've got one more in front of you. Then I've got Representative Mason.
I can just be very brief, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Nash.
I would agree with my colleagues. This is incredibly tone deaf. Having served in a municipal capacity, it was not an onerous thing to submit anything to the state to get an answer back. We never had to do this because the public servants that chose to come and work at the city of Waconia understood what the salary cap was, and we had a very fine city administrator for a very long time that herself said, I understand that making this investment in my own career, in doing something I love, means that I may not get paid everything that I'd like. So when a city administrator actually tells that to you, it's awfully hard to find a compelling reason to do this. But to Representative Kosnick's point, this is really tone deaf right now. Representative Druskowski had it exactly right, so I'm a no. Thank you.
Representative Greenman, quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just like to say, since we're talking about, I wanted to just push back a little bit and make sure that we know that when we're talking about local officials, we're talking about police and fire folks who deliver our, who take care of our roads and our garbage. And so there's lots of folks who are on the front lines who are working through this pandemic. There are people who are keeping our cities and local governments running. And so as we think about what folks need, I just hope that we'll consider that and really trust our local administrations and think about the local control issues. Thank you.
And I missed, before I go to Representative Mason, Representative Carlson, did you want to make a comment as a former city official?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Nelson. And again, I'll be brief as well. So again, thanks to all the testifiers. There was resounding support for this, and I appreciate you were very articulate in making the case here in terms of recruitment, retention. And over again, we heard the word competition. I'm a little bit surprised by our Republican colleagues here. I mean, free markets, competition, no other state has this. It's just the use of this word, calling this tone deaf, that's a false assumption here. That's a false narrative. This is putting into place the mechanisms to ensure with the transparency and accountability. Again, words we heard over and over and over again. So I'm just shocked by the comments from our Republican colleagues here. Representative Druskowski, be assured that there are layoffs, furloughs, pay freezes, and positions left open at a time when public services are needed the most. So if you guys want to talk about local governments and the stress is placed upon public service employees, I'd be more than happy to have that conversation with you offline. So with that, I'm in full support of this bill.
Representative Nash, quickly, I know you're the GOP was called out. Representative
Nash, quickly. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would point out to Representative Carlson that the free market does not use taxpayer money to compete in the market. So thanks for your tone deaf comment.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
Representative Carlson, we're not going to do back and forth here. You said offline, keep it offline. Representative Mason, wrap up. You can wrap up and then renew your motion.
Okay, thank you very much. First of all, before I talk about my bill, I just want to say that the comments made by said the Republican members of this commission are so disrespectful, contentious, and make unrealistic comparisons regarding our local government officials. I mean, their comments are absolutely appalling and certainly don't do justice to the positions that you hold. And you've done it before, but you really need to start paying a little bit of attention about the positions that you hold and the importance of dealing with people, public government workers. So, okay, that's done. I just want to thank all of my testifiers, and hopefully you've listened carefully to what they've been saying and expressing. And I, as I said, I did have this bill last year. It did. We did pass a clean bill out of the House last year, and thank you for voting down the amendment. Again, it was the amendment was basically a Band-Aid. We need to be doing better. It did pass in the Senate as well last year, and they had put on the $200,000 cap instead. But we never ended up with doing the committee to, so it never truly got to the governor's office, but it did pass in both houses. So I just want to correct that. Again, we are the only state that's done this. We've been doing it for a number of years. Nobody's thought that this is a really good thing. So in my opinion, we need to get rid of it. It's not efficient. And I can tell you as a former city council member, I mean, when you go to hire a major employee like the city administrator or manager or public works director, I mean, you put a lot of thought and work into it. In many cases, you will hire a consultant, which costs thousands of dollars. So it's not a duty that's taken lightly. The other thing, again, going back to the Rochester example, where the current system, where it's just not consistent. So again, I'd appreciate your vote for my bill so that we can get our local governments to be able to hire in a real responsible way. Thank you.
And so Representative Mason, you want to renew your motion?
Oh, yes, please. I'd like to move House File 325 to the General Register.
Representative Mason renews her motion that House File 325 be referred to the General Register. Ms. Spreck, can you take the roll?
Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski.
No.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Cleborne.
Aye.
Representative Kosnick.
No.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative New Brindley.
No.
Representative Quam.
No.
With a vote of 7 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails.
That member, the motion prevails, and the bills moved on to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Mason. The next bill we have is House File 344, again, a Representative Mason bill. And Representative Mason, do you want to move to adopt the committee report?
Yes, please. I would like to put that forward and ask for your approval.
Representative Mason moves to adopt the local government division report for House File 344. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The bill's before us. Representative Mason, you want to move your bill for possible inclusion in the committee omnibus bill?
Okay. Thank you very much. This is the staggered term bill. Again, we've heard this before. The Metropolitan Council is probably one of the more contentious organizations that we have, and for good reason, because basically it is to serve the metropolitan communities, but yet it is more responsive to the governor, et cetera. So a number of organizations have done in-depth studies of the governance. And this particular item, the stagger terms, is the at least the main item that keeps coming forward. The stagger terms will provide continuity and historical information going forward. And we, so it's it, this, to me, is an easy at least fix to the Metropolitan Council. And we have a number of people that would like to testify, so I'll let them proceed.
On my list here, I have Patricia Nauman. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to comment today. My name is Patricia Nauman, and I am the Executive Director of Metro Cities, which represents cities in the metropolitan area, the shared interests of cities in the metropolitan area at the legislature, executive branch, and Metropolitan Council. Just very brief background on Metro Cities, Mr. Chair and members, with respect to the council. The association was created roughly concurrently with the establishment of the Metropolitan Council in the early 1970s, and it plays a unique role in the local government advocacy community in that it does represent, it is a region-wide entity that represents the shared interests of cities at the Metropolitan Council. This means that we watch the scope of activity and respond as appropriate to the policy and funding activity of the council. The region's cities consider themselves to be the Metropolitan Council's primary constituency because regional and local growth is primarily managed through city comprehensive planning and the implementation and delivery of public services and policies that come out of the Metropolitan Council. Metro City's policies do cover the scope of Metropolitan Council activity and do include governance. Metro City's policies on governance include a range of things, but they have long supported stagger terms for Metropolitan Council members. The association has periodically conducted task forces to consider governance and certainly has participated in other task forces, for example, by the Citizens League that recently considered governance. The outcomes of all of Metro City's policy work and task forces have included support for four-year stagger terms for Metropolitan Council members, and they remain a core governance position for the association. Metro Cities actually did initiate and support a staggered terms bill that passed the legislature in 2008. It was the last time that a bill of this nature did pass the legislature, and it was vetoed by the governor at the time. Just very briefly, Mr. Chair and members, Metro Cities' support for staggered terms there is support for staggered terms because the association supports, believes that the council, the nature of the work of the council does not lend itself to ideological shifts that can occur when you have sort of what you have, like you could have four-year changes, basically a whole sweeping change of Metropolitan Council members. The council is a long-range planning body and it is responsible for the efficient operation of regional systems. It plays a unique role in that way. And as such, again, it does not lend itself to what can be very sharp shifts in ideology that can occur and affect the operation of those systems and its long-range planning function. So that stands at the sort of sits at the core of the policy, and I appreciate I appreciate the opportunity to comment today and would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, members. That's the only person I have on the list. I have Mr. Judge Shetton from the Met Council to answer any questions. And I see Representative Elkins. Did you have a question or a comment? You're muted.
Thank you. Yeah, sorry. Thank you. I, as most of you know, I served for 8 years on the Metropolitan Council, and before that, I also served when I was a city council member in Bloomington on its Land Use Advisory Commission, and before that, even, I served on its Transportation Advisory Board. And my experience in observing the council from a variety of different perspectives is that what I observed is that with each incoming administration, even if the party of the administration was the same, there would be a wholesale turnover in the membership of the Met Council. So from the Pawlenty administration to the Dayton administration, there was only one carryover. And the transition from the Dayton administration to the Waltz administration, there were only two people carried over. And what I observed as a result of that is because the council has oversight over a variety of very arcane, sometimes even Byzantine processes that are dictated by the state and the federal governments, especially the federal government ones. The learning curve for new members is extremely steep. And when you have wholesale turnovers with each change of administration, what happens is that all of the institutional knowledge in the body rests with the staff, and the staff and the whole, all of the processes become very staff driven. And that furthermore, when there are such wholesale changes from administration to administration, the staff itself becomes timid because they're afraid of being whipsawed with the change of council with each change of administration. And so things happen, it's very difficult to affect change, from the governing body level. So I think I very strongly support these reforms. There have been, as Ms. Nauman has pointed out, the Metro Cities itself, the Citizens League, and now the Governor's Blue Ribbon Council. It's the recommendations always come out the same. And it says, Winston Churchill once said of democracy that it's the worst form of government, except for all of the others that have been tried from time to time. Nobody seems to like the way the Met Council has governed, but the only reforms that have been able to achieve any kind of a consensus are the ones that are reflected in this in this bill. Staggered terms so that there is some continuity in the council from administration to administration, so there's some opportunity to build institutional knowledge that persists from administration to administration, and a greater say for local governments in the appointments to the council. Because when you get down to it, the council accomplishes very little itself except for the operation of most of the transit system and the super system. Everything else it does in cooperation with the region's cities and counties, and it has to have the support of those local governments in order to do its job well. Thank you.
And Representative Bonner, quickly, and I want to get to the amendments. There's two of them. Representative Bonner.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'll try to be brief. First, thank you to Representative Elkins for those comments. You know, as a person who puts together teams for a living, that's sort of the definition 101 of making sure you have a good mix of experience and new and fresh ideas. But that I actually do have a question. This bill came about as a result of the Governor's Blue Ribbon Council on Metropolitan Governance, I believe. And I'm wondering if someone could speak a little bit about the process and the deliberation by which these policy changes came to be the recommendation of the council.
Representative Mason or Ms. Nauman?
I'm going to suggest, because it was the Met Council staff that was serving the actual committee, you might want to ask Mr. Shetnin.
Mr. Shetnin.
Good morning.
Identify yourself. Identify yourself. You know the drill. Identify yourself for the record.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Judd Shetnin. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. So I appreciate the opportunity to be with the committee this morning. And just to be clear, the Governor's Blue Ribbon Committee was made up of an independent body of officials and members who the governor appointed to this. The Met Council staffed it. I staffed this along with a number of other folks. And so this is not an endorsement of the Metropolitan Council or Metropolitan Council staff, but I can speak to the Blue Ribbon Committee. And the committee was chaired by Dakota County Commissioner, former state legislator Mary Liz Holberg. We had a number of former Met Council chairs and regional administrators from different governor administrations, both Republican and Democrat. We had folks from the business community. There were folks from the University of Minnesota, from the private business sector, there were 15 of them all together. And they looked at a variety of different issues. The first about whether or not the council should be an elected or should be an elected body. And they came back with a unanimous decision that having the Met Council as an elected body would not be a good idea. However, they deliberated a bit longer and came back and they arrived at staggered terms. We took a ton of testimony from folks from House Research, from Ms. Nauman's group, Metro Cities. We had folks from the League of Minnesota Women Voters. We had folks from Mr. Mossman's group as well, from MICA. and other groups to talk about that governance piece. I will say that we did talk about other things related to our role in transportation as our Metropolitan Planning Organization, and also as our role in the delivery of regional transit service. But for the purposes of this conversation today, I think it relates to the governance of the Metropolitan Council. And this group spent a lot of time talking about the history of the Metropolitan Council. We looked at what other governors have done and vetoes that governors have done to a similar staggered terms bill in the past, and the reasons for why governors have taken that position, but this is the legislature, and the legislature has the ability to bring forward their bills. And I don't know if there's a specific question about the committee and their work specific to that, but they did all come to a what I believe is pretty close consensus that staggered terms would be the appropriate governance model that they would bring forward. And for the sake of saying this again, this is not an endorsement of the Metropolitan Council, and this is a decision of Governor Walz, and I am here, and my purpose is to provide some background and not to advocate one way or another.
Thank you, Mr. Shetland. Representative Nash, you have the DE1 amendment. Do you want to offer that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The DE1 amendment is an amendment that would bring in an idea that would put gubernatorial proposed Met Council members out to a vote of the region that they would serve and the city councils that they would serve. And really, as we heard, that the democratic process is valuable, apparently, for these sorts of things, is super important to some members of our committee. And I think that putting it to a vote of the local city councils and local county boards and township boards and such. However, I did have a conversation with Representative Mason last night, and she likes the bill and wants to bring it to her committee to give it a hearing with the hope of putting it to the floor. So I will not be offering this amendment, and we'll take Chair Mason up on her offer to hear it and send it to the floor.
Thank you, Representative Nash. The other amendment is the A2 amendment. Representative Kosnick, and you want to explain your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mason. I appreciate your continued efforts on this issue that doesn't seem to really go away, but hopefully I think we're taking, in a good way, a step back from some other proposals that have been proposed in the past that didn't have much support in terms of elected council members. The committee, what this amendment is just simply adds that the chair and the vice chair of the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Governance, it's a subcommission of the legislature, that the chair and the vice chair would be a part of the nominating committee to provide a little bit of context to the Met Council and the from a legislative perspective, because obviously a lot of what the Met Council does comes before the legislature, and it kind of adds that component of having some additional elected legislators participate in the nomination process. So members, I would ask for your support.
So Representative Kosnick moves the A2 amendment. I think that's what I heard him say. Also, Representative Mason, what are your feelings on the amendment? It's your bill.
I'm inclined to accept that. Actually, right now, I am still chair of the Legislative Commission on Metro Governance, and we really don't have a way of imposing or impacting what the Met Council does. Our main function is just to listen to the proposed budget at the end of the year, but that is it. So perhaps adding these officials to the nominating committee will give us a little bit more influence into what's happening. So again, I'm open to taking that.
So Representative Kosnick renews his motion for the A2 amendment. This is a voice vote, members. All in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
I guess the ayes have it. The amendment goes on. With that, Representative, are there any questions on the bill? I don't see any hands up right second. I'll give it a couple seconds here. No one's jumping up here. So Representative Mason, you want to wrap up your bill and then renew your motion?
Thank you very much. First of all, I do want to thank Representative Nash for not introducing his amendment. It's a fairly extensive amendment. So I'm thinking it's I appreciate the fact that he's willing to put it forward as a bill on its own. And then again, reminding people that the governor just did the Blue Ribbon Task Force. Mary Liz Holberg, who is a former House member, served as the chair. And this, the staggered term, came forward again as the main way to, as a way of improving the way Met Council works. So I would appreciate your support for this bill as we go forward. I think it's important for us as members of the legislature to show that we are listening to people, that we are willing to make some changes to make the Met Council a little bit more perhaps accessible to the communities that it serves. Again, I'd appreciate a yes vote for this. Thank you.
And do you want to renew your motion then as amended?
And, okay, I would move that House File 344 be moved to the General Register.
The original was for inclusion. But we can move it, and we can include it also. We can move it to the General Register.
Okay, why don't we do that, please?
Representative, so with that, we're going to hold this bill over for possible inclusion. We don't need to take a vote on that. So members, and this may come back up and get moved on its own later on in the process. With that, members, that concludes our agenda for today. Our meeting on Thursday is, we've got the governor's campaign finance board member appointments. Those are important so that the campaign finance board can continue to operate. And we have House File 70, Representative Freiberg's bill. And if there aren't any questions about that, with that, members, we are adjourned.